Joel, tell me about your interest in the culture of environmentalism. How did this occur and why?
Well, you know, my area of interest is the impact of science and technology on culture and values. But one of the things that I began to think about was, well, what happens when things that start off as science end up becoming more and more like a religion? And some aspects of environmentalism look to me like they are increasingly faith-based. You know, environmentalism started off as a study of the environment through ecology and science. But now when you look out at what people are talking about in terms of, you know, what they believe about the environment, you realize that they've got saints, they've got sinners, they've got prophets, predictions, heretics, demons, sacraments, rituals. In some cases, you know, it's almost like a fundamentalism for the upper middle class. And I got interested in wondering, you know, well, what the heck is that about? You know, is organic food becoming the new communion? Is the ritual buying of the Prius a kind of confirmation? There was a new ABC sitcom last year called The Good Family, and it was about a clan of devoted greens. They had solar panels on their roof, and they harvested rainwater for outdoor showering, and they were vegan and the whole nine yards. Their motto was WWAGD, what would Al Gore do? And in the show, it was a funny show. And the funny show is that they were at the end, the son apologizes for driving a car, which he was only allowed to use in an emergency. He says, sorry, I use so much gas, Dad. And the father responds, it's okay. What's important is that you feel guilty about it. Well, this is the guys who created this show are the same guys who created Beavis and Butthead. So they are.
They know.
They know. They're into it. But the reason it's funny is that there is something serious underpinning an awful lot of this belief system about the environment. That there's, you know, in this, if you're in some of this belief system, there's an initial Eden, a paradise, a kind of a state of grace and unity with nature. Then there's a fall from grace and with pollution as a result of, you know, eating from the tree of knowledge. And then there is a judgment day that's going to come for us all, and we are all energy sinners, doomed to die unless we seek salvation, which we now call sustainability, and on and on. And, you know, on one hand, I don't make fun of any religion, whether it's, you know, Christianity or Buddhism or whatever.
Right.
But the thing that I'm interested in is how I'm convinced that we just don't know enough about the climate, about the environment. There's no way that we've got enough computer firepower to model this completely. So that means that inevitably there will be surprises. It can't not be surprises. And that is going to put a premium on our ability to be adaptable and inventive. And if there are people who are convinced that of the righteousness of their cause, what do you do if you can't change people's minds? The nice thing about science and rationalism and the whole Cartesian project was it was invented originally to help change people's minds without having to go in and kill millions of people. I mean, the question is whether, you know, if you are totally convinced that that nuclear power is bad, that genetically modified food is bad, suppose you have to embrace some of those technologies, you know, in order to not fry the planet. How do you convince people who have embraced this in an almost religious fashion? You know, are we going to end up debating, you know, who is more environmentally pure so long that we watch the planet fry? That's what I'm interested in.
I wonder how many people can be changed. I wonder what polls say in terms of, or any studies, that, you know, if you have 100 people, that you can sway 40% of them all the time, the other 20% never, and then the other 40% maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's the optimistic version. And there are some people who believe that. There's a fellow who runs the Copenhagen Consensus who says his version of it is that, you know, there are 40% who believe one way, 40% who believe another way. There's nothing you can do about either of those. But, you know, but the people in the middle are the ones to go after, and they are the ones who are busy you know, dealing with their kids and getting on with their jobs. And if you make more sense than somebody else does, they'll nod their head and say, yeah, that makes plenty of sense, and they will change their mind. And if that's true, then I'm not that worried. But the problem that I've got is that you know, some very large portion of of the American population doesn't believe in the Darwinian version of evolution, and that's the entire basis of biological science today. So, you know, if you can't change people's minds about something as basic as evolution, then what happens if you've got people who are, you know, totally convinced that that the planet is going to hell and you can't change their minds? One of the guys I talked to was a guy named James Lovelock. He's a chemist in Britain, and nobody would know his name except for the fact that back in the 60s, he observed that the planet was behaving as if it was one single organism, with everything in it, including us, behaving as if it were cells or parts of this organism.
Sure. And I could believe that. It's almost like the Gaia theory.
That's it. He's the Gaia hypothesis.
That's him?
He's the guy.
All right.
That's Jim Lovelock.
Okay.
And so that's why people now know who he is. Well, he's now in his 90s, and he's written this his last book. And he is taking on this idea of carbon Calvinism, or, you know, environmentalism as religion. And he's saying that, okay, suppose that, you know, that climate change is coming at us ever faster. You know, perhaps we're going to have to deal with geoengineering, which is intentionally, you know, we have been changing the planet with our actions for a long time, but suppose we have to start intentionally doing it, and in order to try to reverse climate change. And one of the ideas that he embraces is the idea of taking every commercial airliner on Earth, and for the rest of time, putting a couple of tons of sulfuric acid on board on every flight. And when they're in the stratosphere, he wants to spray aerosol sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere. And the reason for this, apparently, is that if you do this, you'll get some kind of a chemical reaction that will allow radiation from the sun to reflect back into space, reducing the heat, and this will compensate for the reflectivity that you're losing with the melting of the polar ice caps. And I said, okay, Jim, baby.
So, and some may say we're doing that now.
Yeah, well, not
these chemtrails.
Not at the scale, the scale that he's talking about.
Right, right.
So, I mean, not enough to change global warming. So I said, Jim, hey, look, you have convinced some very large portion of the human race that the planet is acting as if it was a living organism, and you've given it a name. You've named it Gaia after a Greek goddess, and you've totally convinced people that, you know, of this you know, quasi-religious notion. Now you're talking about injecting sulfuric acid into her veins. You know, how are you going to do this? How are you going to convince people, you know, that you've managed to proselytize?
Sure.
And he says, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's a very good point. I'm glad I'm 90 years old. It's going to be somebody else's problem.